Good morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. Theosophy is the accumulated wisdom of the ages that has been checked, tested, and verified by countless generations of sages and perfected beings. And no one truth was accepted as true until it was checked against the findings of others. So we have before us these ideas, and to better keep these ideas before the public, we have formed an association of students to keep these ideas alive in the world today. Now, we at this lodge keep these ideas before the public, and they are embodied in three fundamental ideas or propositions, which in themselves formulate the idea of universal brotherhood, which is a truer realization of the self. Now, we hold these truths to be self-evident, but we keep before the public these ideas through a similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. And we consider all as theosophists who are in the true service of humanity. Now, to keep these ideas relevant, we have developed a program. Now, this program is carried out each week on Sundays and on Wednesdays. And occasionally, we have special meetings, as we will this Friday. We will have a special meeting on Friday night from 7 to 8. The doors open at 6:30. This Friday, we're going to be discussing symbols, and in particular, the cross and the Tao. Now, not only on Friday do we have a special meeting this week, but on Saturday as well. And this is an interlodge symposium. And it will be entitled Ancient Messages for Modern Times. Now, this will be held at the Constitution Center here in Philadelphia. And it will begin at 11 a.m. and be over approximately at 4 p.m. So this is this Saturday. We have a busy week ahead of us. But before we get to Friday or Saturday, we have Wednesday. We have a Wednesday class. And this is a study class, and it's from 7:45 until 9 p.m. We are presently reading in this the Ocean of Theosophy, and this Wednesday will be a continuation on the cycle on cycles, or the subject of cycles. Now, on Sundays, we hold a special meeting where we take up theosophical ideas, and for the month of April, we are taking up theosophy and symbols and myths. And last Sunday was a talk on Easter. Today will be a talk on the power of symbol and sound. And the next two Sundays of the month, next Sunday will be the battles of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, and on the 25th, the allegories of Plato. Now, we also have a card available to those who find these ideas or are in sympathy with these ideas. And it simply states that being in sympathy with the purpose of this lodge, as set forth in its declaration, I hereby record my desire to be enrolled as an associate. It being understood that such association calls for no obligation on my part other than that which I myself determine. And this is available at the book table if you so wish to associate yourself. Now, this afternoon's talk is on the power of symbol and sound. And we'll begin by just simply reading this one paragraph. The secret doctrine, or theosophy, is the accumulated wisdom of the ages, and its cosmogony alone is the most stupendous and elaborate system. even in the esotericism of the Puranas. But such is the mysterious power of occult symbolism that the facts which have occupied countless generations of initiated seers and prophets to marshal, to set down and explain in the bewildering series of evolutionary progress are all recorded on a few pages of geometrical signs and glyphs. The flashing gaze of those seers has penetrated into the very kernel of matter and recorded the soul of things there, where an ordinary profane, however learned, would have perceived but the external work of form. This morning we are going to have a talk on the power of symbol and sound.
Good morning. The power of symbol and sound. When you first hear it, it doesn't seem like those two would be wedded or complementary to one another, although they both are speaking of communication. But theosophy says, or tells us, or teaches us, that every nation's religious and esoteric history is embedded in symbols and never expressed in words. Allegory and parable contain all the thoughts and emotions, all the learnings and knowledge, both revealed and acquired, of the early races. You may ask, why? Because the spoken word has a power that is unknown, unsuspected, and disbelieved in by modern sages. Also, because sound and rhythm are closely related to the elemental powers of nature, and because certain vibrations in the air can awaken corresponding powers which can produce good or bad results. For these reasons, students were never allowed to recite historical, religious, or any real events in so many unmistakable words, lest the powers connected with the event should be once more attracted. Such events were narrated only during the initiation, and every student had to record them in corresponding symbols drawn out of his own mind and examined later by his master before they were finally accepted. Thus was created in time the Chinese alphabet, as before that, the hieratic symbols were fixed upon in old Egypt. In the Chinese language, the alphabet, of which may be read in any language, and which is only a little less ancient than the Egyptian alphabet of Thoth, every word has its corresponding symbol conveying the word needed in a pictorial form. The language possesses many thousands of such symbol letters or logograms, each meaning a whole word. For letters proper or an alphabet do not exist in the Chinese language any more than they did in the Egyptian till a far later period. Now, the preceding I was read to you because it does show not only the relation but also the power. The idea that certain words, certain rhythms can call upon forces in nature and put them at the beck and call of those who have called, you know, who have brought them forth. People who don't understand and might do this by accident can invite perhaps disaster or unintended results. Just as languages are rooted in sound forms, so are symbols, allegorical, emblematical, hieroglyphical, mystical, and parabolic. All are based on soul sounds, which make up the ancient archaic Esoteric Science. Theosophy, through HPB, states that symbolism is the language of the soul, which reaches beyond sex, caste, creed, color, and race. In other words, beyond all realms of the personality. Now, Western thinking has a peculiar idea. Well, I shouldn't say a peculiar idea, but they have a certain set idea on how they deal with their search for truth. And it instructs you never to accept anything for truth which you didn't know to be as such. Now, looking at this, we learn one thing about this idea is that the fear of error. They don't want to make a mistake. They fear error. Therefore, they accept nothing for the truth except that which they already know to be the truth. Now, when we realize what this is, you have to understand that truth is relative. And it conflicts with the ancient idea of what truth is. For the ancient idea spoke to seven or more levels at one time. So it was true on every level, but not able to be perceived on every level, because we cannot go beyond what we perceive. And our perception of truth is what we perceive it to be at that particular level. As we rise, we might say, oh, wow, I didn't see this before. I didn't understand this before. Truth has come to me in a different light and in a different form. The wise and ancient ones who wrote in this symbolic language understood that and accounted for it and made room for it by writing on more than one level at the same time. So it was possible for a student to, as he grew, to see the same thing and at each time see something new or something different or something more truthful than what he had perceived the first time. This fits right in with the theosophical idea, the three fundamentals of theosophy, because it has taken into account the fact that man is a growing, ever-expanding force, that he is never the same. He grows, he is expanding, he evolves. And there's a message there, whatever level he evolves to, left by those who have evolved before him. This is part of the fundamental principles of theosophy. And there is no fear for mistakes, because mistakes will take care of themselves, and they themselves are often a reward. We learn from them, just like we learn from the things that we do right the first time. They show us what not to do, just like we're shown what to do. Now, the occult idea of truth is known only through egoic contact. And the author of a symbolic message seeks to transmit to the reader not words, but ideas, complete ideas. And the reader is required to make an investment, and a heavy investment, because he has to invest himself in meshing his intuition with the intuition of the writer. We might use as an analogy a sheet of photographic paper that has been exposed and the image is on that photographic paper already, but it won't be seen until the developer is applied. This is the same thing. The image is there, it needs the application. The message is there, it needs the application of the intuition of the reader in order to understand that message, in order to perceive it, in order to get the full benefit of it. Now, why did these ancient wise men, why did they pick the symbolic means of transferring or communication? And, you know, if they wanted to hide it from the profane, they could simply bury it somewhere in the world. They could put it in an inaccessible place with and leave messages to those whom they wanted to find it where it would be. That seems as though it would be a simpler way to do it. But actually, their reasons for doing it were more profound. Number one, it is symbols are the most accurate way to share profound philosophical ideas. We can see anyone who's bought a toy for their child or a piece of furniture that had to be assembled understands what can be lost in translation when it comes to these types of things. And here we're dealing with metaphysical ideas that challenge the best of minds. How best to communicate to this searcher the true reward of what it is that he searches for. And that's what they attempt to do. And also, it builds within the student the courage to go forth, the courage not to be afraid of making a mistake, the courage, and also it makes his mind more porous, which we've been told many times in this room. These ideas that come to us aren't just coming to us as mere one-dimensional facts. These are indeed helping us to grow, helping us to develop the courage we need to proceed, and also the desire and the forethought and the foresight to see beyond where we could have seen before. Ideas that we would have automatically dismissed become possible. We begin to look in the realms where we've never seen before. So that is the reason that this was used, symbolic language was used. Now, the uninitiated soul is like an infant, and he doesn't understand the language of his own land. But listening to his elders, he picks up a symbol. He begins to be able to assemble them, and eventually he can recite them. He knows them. He understands what they are. He has a feeling for them. And then beyond that, he goes into perhaps learning how to either write them or put them together so that they produce a whole meaning. So this is how he uses it. But in the process of learning how to use it, he makes mistakes. He makes errors. These errors are called gray magic because they don't express the full truth. They only express half the truth. And something that we learned too also, this exalted communication is a tool. And like all tools, it is colorless. It only reflects the intent and motive of the person using it. Therefore, the same word that can be a blessing can also be a curse or a blaspheme. And those who are given to the darker side of nature use the same tools that those who bring light use, but they use them for selfish means, selfish purposes, their own ambitions, their own desires. That is a corruption of a very exalted language but it is possible for it to happen. Now, the transition required in the life of a student of theosophy is more than a change from selfish to unselfish ways, although nothing is accomplished without this. There's also a transition in the very idea of knowledge and in where it may be sought, how it is to be tested, and what its result after it has been obtained. The self-reliance often spoken of in the teaching is that in man, when he conceives and then confirms it, the human being is a luminous being, each possessed of an inner vision, such as belongs to the gods themselves. It is to this discovery that the world of symbolism invites us. Symbols are a path to that existence in which life and knowledge are one and inseparable.
So stated, symbols are the language of the soul. So I guess something we probably know very little about, because we barely understand the language that we speak.
What we're thinking as we were hearing the information in the talk is that the early teachings were oral. And we're wondering, it just seems like even people who read poetry out loud, it has more depth to it when one hears it rather than reading them themselves. So there must be something to that.
Well, the idea just presented is that these teachings were passed on from generation to generation by the spoken word. And we just have to go back and reference ourselves that everything that began, it began from a vibration. We're talking about cycles in our study class. And from at a moment, a certain vibration is elicited, and that is carried forward. Well, this is what our existence is a vibration. So it was mentioned that the occult power of sound is great. It has an influence not only in the air, but in the subtle atmosphere that we don't see, but is inhabited by other entities. And these are the powers of nature. And it takes it doesn't take a perfected being to elicit these. We have probably all heard stories of people who can talk to animals or understands or by a certain word gets them to respond, which is really perhaps an inherent quality or something that they have learned accidentally but aren't able to communicate to anybody else how they do it. So the power of sound is just that, very powerful and transformative.
Well, the oral knowledge that was handed down from generation to generation was just to a few, we understand. It wasn't to the many. And there were preservers and keepers of this knowledge. And there would have to be the use of sound, symbol, color, intonation. It had to be perfect, we would imagine, for that transmission. And the vehicle, the person who was the listener, the Shravaka, would have to be receptive, be the proper receptacle in order to receive this information and then in turn pass it on.
We would think that the statement, it relates to the fact of the purity of these words or these ideas. Well, and that the person presenting them would be of a pure nature. Well, we live in this world. Our natures aren't pure. But we are acting out these same ideas in our feeble attempts to keep these ideas alive. That we do not understand our true power. For if we did, perhaps this world would be in a better or a worse condition than what it is now. So we are unfolding. Our powers are unfolding. And so that what we can do is understand these ideas. Understand and be able to speak them. That's what we are asked to do. Do we talk about realities? Do we talk about reincarnation? Do we talk about karma? Maybe we don't use those words, but we try to express those ideas. Well, there are certain symbols that are found on our churches and our synagogues and throughout our communities that elicit these truths. So they're an opportunity for us to understand and see where they lie and engage others.
And as we've heard and understand that civilizations rise and then go out, perhaps we'll hear this coming Saturday, those visual symbols left around the world in different times and different places are perhaps more universal reminders of the great truth than the particulars kept in the line of the peoples, because we know, of course, civilizations rise and fall, but then we also know at the appropriate time the holders of that wisdom do reappear and bring it back to us. So we're ripe with not only the philosophy we're studying here, but these ancient symbols around the world, and it's exactly what Saturday's proceedings will be about.
Well, that's quite interesting. Well, what are these symbols that are found throughout the world? Do we know them? We all know what they are. We've been presented with them from our earliest childhood. What are they? Give me one.
Pyramids.
The pyramids. And where are they found? Just in Egypt? They're found all over the world. What are some other symbols that are found, even in this country? In Ohio, what's in Ohio? The serpent mound. You know, they're found throughout our culture. And we just don't look. Or we don't know that these are ancient symbols that stir something up within us. The wanting to understand what they truly mean. You know, why would these cultures, civilizations build these great pyramids? Why? Why in that shape? Why facing that direction? Why? What about England? Are there any symbols in that country? Stonehenge. But Stonehenge is only a great representation of markers that are found throughout that continent. There are many symbols that are found there and that are markers of even magnetic energies that are still resonant within the earth.
Well, you know, in our time, the Catholic Church changed their method and do not give out their sermons in Latin as they used to. And we often have been treated to a program where we listen to the cantor speak or sing. And it has an effect on us, even though we don't know what the words mean. But the tone seems, is that symbolic, a language that we're referring to?
We would think that these expressions of song, when we hear something in a melodic way, it raises us up. It takes us into another state of consciousness. Almost in a state where we feel blissful, or if we let ourselves go, let it go for the moment, so that we often as a child remember tales of, was it King David, the notes and the with the elementals that gathered around him, or they said elemental, but as a child they said these powers of sound that surrounded him. So myth and legend about certain great figures in biblical times or in just the history of man that stay alive.
In regards to sound and the opposite from feeling blissful, we know that there's a lot of music, especially today, that when you listen to it, it agitates. It can stir up, you know, anger and frustration in people. But then we look at the whirling dervishes and how they respond to music and to sound. They go into that blissful state. So the music, the vibrations, can certainly set up in humans different, depending upon the levels, can set up different reactions.
Well, you bring up a curious phenomenon. You know, our culture is bombarded by sound. Music, you as mentioned, good disruptive in one hand and melodious on the other, but we have to remember one thing, that the dervishes, they hear sound, but what are they thinking about when these sounds are being made? What are they considering? They're actually digesting the sound, and it's making them a part of themselves. We hear music, we're not paying attention. It's just like it's just a distraction. And that's part of our passivity. Turn the radio on, listen to music. We're not really listening, it's just sort of coming at us. We're not in that music. We're just there, like it's a distraction from the driving or from whatever. So if a sound is not digested or have a mental vibration or meaning to us, it has no power. As said in the presentation, we give it the power, and our understanding of certain statements. The word wife, that word conjures up an image in us that has many different meanings, but it's a symbol. Husband, father, mother, all those are symbols, but they're sounds which evoke in us an image. Reincarnation, it evokes in us an image. So the sound is so powerful that they are used oftentimes to create something and give me liberty or give me death. What was the cry of the French Revolution? A fraternity, brotherhood, or, you know, but they were equality, which
and liberty.
Liberty made the masses rise up. Those words alone, the feeling that they evoked within the person that was holding those ideas.
The chair gave the declaration and program for the next few weeks. And they were given out, it seemed that sort of prepared us for the talk in a way. So we come into these rooms, and there's always something giving out, a declaration of the fundamentals or something. And then the main talk is given out. It seems like that's sort of a preparation to get everybody in the same tone.
The idea being presented is one that's very occult, is that when we go to any place, we either make it sacred or make it profane. To make it sacred, one dwells on the ideas which are held within this place. Whether you walk into a church or a synagogue or any building at all, it's the reverence in which you hold. in your heart. And it's what in what the living power of your own thoughts and speech, which are generated there. Because when you go into a gathering of people, what do? You speak to each other. What ideas do you hold and that you bring in with you? Well, the ideas, hopefully, that are presented in this gathering. And the whole idea of this association are to elevate our profane or mundane thoughts into those that are more spiritual and deal with the reality of life, which is a soul life. So how do we pay attention to our soul life? Well, we begin by saying that we are not these bodies, but we are more than that. So it's a beginning of understanding.
We know there have been studies done with plant life where they played certain kinds of music and they had results. Or people who love plants or are gardeners and so forth know that and can prove that with gentle speech and loving thoughts, the plants will grow better and fuller and bigger. So we were thinking the effect that we have on nature with sound. You know, we always seem to be in a time of war and strife somewhere on the globe, and we get great disasters, earthquakes and hurricanes and tsunamis, and fail to see that these are the outlets for what we have put into motion, often with sound, certainly with intention. So we're interconnected in ways we just fail to see sometimes, and can prove it to ourselves with experiments like that.
By observation, we know that we are all connected. Whether we acknowledge it or not is the problem. But we are all connected. And that it's stated in the occult teachings that the effects that we see around us are really the product of man. That is not hard for us to understand, because if there is so much energy of a certain kind in a certain place, certain things begin to manifest themselves. You know, certain storms, earthquakes, hurricanes. I mean, certain disasters, smog and pollution, are ones which we know that we have created. We just do not see beyond that which we can see. In that very subtle atmosphere that surrounds us, we are affecting it. And it is being disturbed. And it has to come back into equilibrium, with or without our help.
In Asia, the writing in China and Japan, the pictographs, they can each, even though they don't speak the same language, they can each understand and read whatever is written, which is very interesting, and you would think it's maybe they're more advanced than us, but there's also, in the Secret Doctrine, it talks about, or it might be in Isis, but anyway, it talks about that the Chinese are a dying race. So we're wondering if the old Chinese, if that were they the ones that came up with these pictographs, and if so, well, English, for instance, is not very abstract, and Sanskrit also is, which comes from English, is not abstract, but. Yet, or it is abstract. Excuse me, we're abstracting in the right.
Yes. Well, the word abstract is an important clue to the answer to your question, because abstract is the language of the soul. You know, because through an abstract idea, you develop your intuition about its meaning, about its understanding. And the ideographs and the symbolism in Chinese language and Japanese and in this part of the world are a part of an ancient language. the origin of which goes back to another age. We have in, we find in the, I guess it's in the Voice of the Silence, in the back is the Book of Zohn, which is another, or in fact what the secret doctrine is based on, are words which we have no idea what they could possibly mean, let alone how to sound them. But within them are great truths hidden.
There's an article written by Mr. Alvin Boyd Kuhn. He talks about the alphabet, our alphabet, the English alphabet, and the esoteric meanings written in those. And it's very enlightening because some of the letters, the O, for example, eternal, the V, the descent of the soul and the rise of the soul, the T is the cross. But he brings to each of the letters a certain understanding that might otherwise be overlooked by most of us. And the idea of it is that we didn't escape all of the mysteries simply because we live in the West.
No, and we shouldn't be so, think that we are so stupid or uneducated in the fact that our language is based on symbols. They're all symbolic. Now, in Hebrew, those symbols have meaning, but the meaning are of seven. There is a numerical value for each letter. And it's said that mantras or words placed together to elicit a certain sound or effect are mathematical equations or symbolic or geometric representations. So we become more and more confused because that in itself is an abstract idea for us. And that makes us stretch our mind and our consideration of what is real. Because what is real to us, well, A, we know it. A is a valve. And we have a set a meaning for it only on this materialistic plane. But there are deeper meanings that lie behind it, which if you do not know you have a soul, you would not be interested in it.
But it seems though that in our time, during this particular period, our materialistic society has taken a great number of these ideas, these symbolic ideas, and has actually extracted any meaning from them at all. They use them in a materialistic way, on the internet, the radio, the shows, and even in the restaurants we go in to eat. All around us is the language, but do we hardly know it? It's considered in some areas blasphemous in a way to see these ideas being dragged in the mud by ourselves and how we talk and how we interpret things.
Well, for that very reason, most of the ancient ideas and truths are kept on symbols. They're contained within a symbol, within the cross, within the Tao, within the Star of David. The truths are hidden there, and so they need not be spoken. That if someone has any kind of understanding, will see the truth within that symbol. So, but we have to be reminded that these ideas are before the public, and these very ancient truths are there, but they're hidden because they, when they are heard and seen, the mundane, materialistic point of view is taken. And if that is all that there is that outer shell that one sees or hears, not the truth that lies within it. That is for the person themselves to see that truth.
I think one important thing that we need to remember is that symbols, whether they are visual or audible, sound or vision, enter our consciousness not through the mind, but they are directly perceived. They will be differently perceived by different people depending on their experiences. But we really perceive them directly into our consciousness. Yes, we can say, okay, the cross means this, and the triangle means this, and that's the mind. But right, what we perceive internally doesn't go through the mind. And that's a very important thing about when you look at advertising, for instance. The advertising industry bombards us with symbols. And we don't really pay attention with our mind. We just internalize them without that.
Yes, and we do that with, mostly, we do that with everything.
With everything.
Everything.
Now, there's a good part in that.
Yes,
but I think the important part is that we need to realize that we perceive these symbols directly.
Yes, and that is, as was mentioned, that the materialist knows that the perception of an idea or a symbol provokes something within someone, either to buy something or to sell something or to be a part of something or to accept something as the truth, you know, because it becomes part of our being. Well, what happens that if these ideas are used over and over again to the detriment of humanity, that there is a backlash eventually over years, a millennium perhaps, it will take it for a reaction. But there is a reaction because the soul itself that was perceiving this cannot absorb any more of that. It has to be free. And so that wanting to be free has gotten us to these rooms. We have searched and searched for what is this idea of freedom? What is this idea of truth? How do I see it and where do I find it? And all the great teachings point to the self within. There is where the truth lies. There is where dwells that which is eternal, boundless, immutable, and omnipresent, and which is the witness of the ever-changing phenomena of life. And that is what we need to be in touch with, so that these things do come to us. But if our mind is centered on the reality, we are not taken off course by this. There's something that is found in Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms, which is somewhat difficult to read, but what it states is that we are mind beings, and if we want to change the world or ourselves, we need to control the mind. And we do this through meditation and concentration. But Patanjali states by mutterings. What is a muttering? Well, muttering is the saying audibly or to ourselves of a word or a phrase over and over and over again. But not just automatically, but dwelling on the meaning of that word or that phrase. It's a repetition of sound. And what it does, it centers the mind. And it's used to develop meditation and concentration. But the warning that is given by this great teacher is that it can't be done passively. You can, you know, if you hear the monks chanting, you know, it seems like a repetitious drone. And it may well be, but it may be something more spiritual, But only that monk knows that by dwelling upon the meaning of what they are saying. Take, for instance, the expression Om, the name of God. But then again, God, what does that conjure in our mind? What meaning does that have? Well, to a theosophist, it has a distinctive meaning. But to a Christian and to a Jew, it has another, more limited meaning. But the expression of Om has a triple meaning. It has to do with Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, and what that sound creates. And we are told to consider that when saying that word to ourselves. So that's just an example of what a mantra can do. It can really change an individual when it is done mindfully and with a purpose, with its meaning. And it is one of the greatest aids we have to develop this concentration, to develop this relationship with our soul.
We were thinking the control factor there. We imagine there must be individuals throughout time we can think of who were able to, in a sense, hypnotize groups of people. So it speaks to, by the power of speech, so it speaks to the real importance of that awakeness and awareness and paying attention. If we are passive, if we are wishy-washy, if we're prone to daydream, it takes one aware, intent soul to take control, and we give it over without even realizing it's the most dangerous thing in the world.
But that happens, and we don't expect it to happen. We are guarding ourselves, but what happens is that something in us is provoked, that we are better, we are greater than, or we have a origin that is greater than what it is now. A nationalism arises, okay? And a separateness that we are greater. And it only takes a leader to evoke that in a mass of people. We see that in the history of mankind. And we wonder very seriously, as presented in our talk, that the history of mankind was never audibly repeated, never written down in so many words, because it would elicit or provoke that same idea to manifest itself again and again and again. And what do we see in the world today? We see the gerbil-like cage of these ideas keep on going around and around and around, and we see the results of it. Confusion and chaos, unsettledness, no trust, war and violence.
And we see a correspondence in the body to that taking things in mindlessly is just the fact that there's, in the past, 300 years at least, refined sugar, what it has done. I mean, really, it's wreaked havoc on the body and the mind because it makes the mind passive.
Well, we would suggest that, yes, we can vilify sugar, but we need to place it in perspective. No one stuck it in our mouth. Okay? And once we got it in our mouth once, there's a weakness that we all seem to have. You know, and we continued. And we know that through the science that we have developed, in our commercial science, that all forms of sugar have been exploited. And the mass of humanity has been, because of this inherent weakness in our physical makeup, that our whole population has been polluted with this sweetness, and it led to all kinds of health problems that we are just beginning to see. But this goes back to the question of morality within a society, or morality within a group of people. And right now, morality is not a factor in our commercial way of life. Money is. So therefore, we are seeing the consequences of that. And hopefully, because of that, as stated, that our mistakes are our best teachers. Our suffering are our best teachers. So there, again, yes, we have been exposed to that evil white stuff, and we have taken it in as our brother, and we are paying the price for it.
In line with what you're saying now, and two statements ago, about passivity and chaos in the world, and when you think about the technology today, those who are approaching our lower natures or desire natures through advertising, they have sound, they have light, they have symbol, they have all the tools to get to you and being passive. But we're seeing that this technology is around the world, and there's a backlash of which you've made a statement, where there's chaos. It looks like the human nature is going in a certain direction, which is in opposition to the direction that it's been, I don't know if you say pushed or led. So it seems like we're in a time of transition, and that's why theosophy is important today.
Well, there's a dichotomy that was mentioned of selfishness, unselfishness, and selflessness. Those are three human conditions. We all go in and out of them all the time. Some don't ever get out of the one. And that commercialism and selfishness breeds more selfishness. And that people begin to see the unity of life. And they begin to understand that selfishness only begets more selfishness. And that there has to be an abdication of our own selfishness to unselfishness. And we begin transforming ourselves with the world around us. So it's really, you know, the world is in such a chaotic state, it's our fault. We have played a role in all of this. So all we have to do is distinguish how can we try to bring it back into balance. And that begins with us, our attitude, our consumption of sugar. Now, the things that we do become very important. The things that we say, the sounds that we make, the things that we hold as sacred, you know, the life that we lead. Yes.
So if we greet one another and remember looking into the eyes of the other, that there is divinity in all, we might be more careful with the sounds that we make and the symbols we put forward. It's the active, awake, and aware state of mind that we need to work on.
Well, it's sort of like this. We look into the eyes of another, and we don't need to think anything. We just need to be at peace with them. And that if we love ourselves, we certainly will love them, or we can love them, and it's just a matter of our attitude that we have developed. Well, we hope you found these ideas helpful and for further consideration. Well, we'd like to remind you that all activities at this lodge are done through voluntary contributions of time, service, and money, and all are welcome to participate. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you, Mike.